This is Line One, Your Health Connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. As those of you who listen to the program a lot, I'm trying to constantly have people think about the importance of science, critical thinking, and what's very important is to always ask yourself, is the treatment or the advice safe and effective? If it's not effective, what difference does it make if it's not safe or not? So one way to do that is to test things and see, are they safe and are they effective? And that's gotten even into policy making, which is good to see. Wouldn't it be nice if all our legislators had to show that whatever legislation they were introducing was both safe and effective before they introduced it? Anyway, off the subject. Here is an interesting bit of legislation that just shows you some benefit. Cigarette smoking has been banned in workplaces and public places in a number of places, a number of cities around the country, and continued supervision, looking at those numbers of how that's affected things is continued. And recently there's been a report that looking at Pueblo, Colorado, where both smoking in workplaces and public places has been shown in the first year of that legislation to decrease the number of hospitalizations for myocardial infarction or heart attacks by 27%. There's been 9 other studies that have shown similar things, but now another 18 months later, an additional 19% of decrease in hospitalization of myocardial infarctions was shown in Pueblo, Colorado. That's the first time of continued ongoing decrease in heart attacks and hospitalizations in a city that where this was done. So it's also looked at in control cities around the Pueblo, Colorado area, and there were no change. So that rules out the possibility that it was something going on throughout the close other communities unrelated to that legislation. Again, it should make those policymakers who are trying to promote some healthy policy decisions feel good about themselves. Today, we're going to be talking about genetic counseling. This is an area that is growing in importance and in need and in use, and I thought it might be very good to kind of bring up to date what we know about genetic counseling, which gets us into genetics a little bit, but also what's available locally and what you can expect to get from genetic counselors. My guests are Maggie Miller, who's a certified genetic counselor with the Providence Cancer Center. She was trained at the University of Minnesota and has been up here a couple of years, long enough to have her name changed from Maggie Dewhurst to Maggie Miller, it appears. And also Audrey Burke. Audrey Burke is also a certified genetic counselor. She's been in practice for over 20 years and currently works with the Alaska Perinatology Associates. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
What's a perinatologist? Let's start with something simple.
Oh, the perinatologists do high-risk obstetrical care.
Okay. So there are obstetricians that have been even further subspecialized, and they get patients referred to them who have very, very – are increasingly high-risk issues with delivery, I guess.
It can be delivery or just – patients with serious medical issues that require extra care.
Yeah, and some of those are genetic related.
Some of them are, yes.
That's why you're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's get some definitions. What I'd like to do to start the program is talk about what a geneticist is, what a genetic counselor is, what's a medical geneticist, and then I'm going to try to get us to define some of those genetic terms we're going to maybe use quite a bit. So what's a genetic counselor?
Genetic counselors are professionals with master's degrees who are trained in explaining hereditary or genetic conditions. They help families and patients understand the risk of recurrence or something happening again, and also how to modify risk and further understand that health care.
And your training, as you told me before, was not only just the molecular biology or the cell biology of genetics, what's going on, but also counseling psychology, and we'll probably help people understand why being good counselors and understanding counseling is important before the day is over. And then also this day-to-day medical genetics issues.
Correct. And basically I look at us as not only educators, but then also counselors in helping patients make decisions.
Audrey, what's a geneticist?
I think of a geneticist as anybody trained in genetics. Usually I'm thinking of a person's like a PhD who works in laboratories, does a lot of the basic research. That's my definition of geneticist.
So they're not necessarily doing patient care as much as they're trying to understand how the basics of genetics are working in the lab for the most part.
Correct.
Or in epidemiologic kind of stuff.
Correct.
So a medical geneticist then is a what?
A physician with a specialized training in genetics. That's like a four-year fellowship typically.
Mm-hmm. And what do?
They actually diagnose patients with genetic conditions, and that's where Audrey and I are limited. Mm-hmm. We can be suspicious, and we can help patients in facilitating testing. But a physician with a degree in genetics or a physician medical geneticist would actually do a physical exam and make a diagnosis.
All right, so let's get some other terms defined here. What's a chromosome?
Well, a chromosome is just a structure that contains our genetic information, and we have a certain number.
Okay, so all animals have a certain number of chromosomes, and they contain the genetic information, and they then deliver that information to their offspring.
Correct.
Which is mixed in there with their other mate.
Correct.
Right? Okay. So what's a gene then?
We think of a gene as basically an instruction unit to make a protein. And proteins have jobs. So I think of the genes as the instruction unit for our entire human body.
Okay. I'm struggling here because the whole idea of a gene is changing a little bit, and I wanted to kind of get into that. I mean, that's the way I was taught, is that genes made proteins, but it turns out we have a heck of a lot more proteins than we got genes.
Sure.
How's that work?
Well, we have a lot to learn. We think some of those proteins may be involved in making stress. And so some genes actually have certain functions during specific times and in specific parts of our body, but may actually have different functions in other parts of our body. Different things can turn those genes on and off, and I know that you had mentioned that you're interested in this subject.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, and it turns out also genes have maybe different structures. There's exons, right?
Exactly.
So yeah, exons can, I'm learning that can be mixed around so that you may have three or four exons, but one exon works with also another exon on another gene. So it turns out, even though we've only got, 26,000 genes or something? So it's gotten, and that's only the basis of the complexity. So understanding the complexity helps maybe as we get further along in the program and why we can't be, we're much better than we used to be, but there's still some doubt about certain things we get to talking about, and that's sometimes frustrating. Are there other basic things, questions I wanted to ask about? Let me see. Chromosomes, patterns of inheritance we haven't talked about. Somebody want to mention the typical ones and how you think about those patterns of inheritance?
I can do that. Main ones I think about are autosomal dominant, autosomal recessive, and
autosomal
X-linked.
Autosomal means not on the X-linked,
correct,
X or Y chromosome.
If we go back to chromosomes, we have numbered chromosomes called autosomes, and then we have a pair of gender chromosomes or sex chromosomes.
And women have two X's and men have an X and a Y.
Right.
Typically.
Or they should. And in dominant inheritance, you only need one chromosome with that gene to be passed on to an individual to have the condition. In recessive inheritance, it's like a hidden gene or recessive where you have to have two copies of the gene on that chromosome to have the condition. And X-linked means the gene is on the X chromosome.
Okay. And so dominant, yeah, it means, and then recessive is, and if you got an X chromosome that's got a recessive and the person is a boy, then they may still have that problem. Is that right?
Correct, because there's no counteracting on the Y.
And that's gotten blurred a little bit, as I understand it also, but that's the classic way we think of inheritance. Right. And DNA is the genetic material that is what is underlying all of these genes and chromosomes when you really break it down to the farthest part.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me ask or let our listeners know and remind you, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guests today are Maggie Miller and Audrey Burke. They're genetic counselors at Providence Hospital. One works in the Providence Cancer Center, is really much more knowledgeable about the area of cancer genetic counseling. and Audrey works with a perinatologist. But we're open for any questions or comments about genetic counseling today, and here's how you can get a hold of us. If you hear something during the day, during the program today, or you have questions on your mind, you can reach us in three ways. Our local telephone number is 550-8433, 550-8433. And there's a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and an email address, line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, lumped together, at kska.org. We'll be here from 2 to 3 or just before 3. If you're listening between 7 and 8, it's a taped broadcast. Remember also, if you hear something you want to listen to again, go to kska.org and look up line 1 on the program. You can listen at any time to this program or refer other people to listen to it. How does a patient decide on what type of genetic specialist they need? What's the typical way, you know, that works?
Typically, their physician is going to be making a referral, and so they're the ones that have a good understanding of where genetic services are available. Alaska has a lot of limitations, and so our physicians are still trying to learn, and it has changed over time. But in our state, if you have a pediatric situation or a kid that has no known diagnosis or reason for their problems, it's typically going to go to our state clinic. Pregnancies, see Audrey, and cancers or other known conditions are typically people who see me.
You said our state clinic. What do you mean by that?
The state of Alaska actually has a genetic services. I don't know if it's a grant, but I believe that's how it's worded. And they fly up two geneticists from the University of Washington at Seattle Children's every 2 months, and a genetic counselor comes along with them, and they work on diagnosing children.
Okay. And you get your consults because you're in cancer epidemia or cancer the clinic of the cancer center over there from other physicians involved with cancer care, or patients come in off the street that just have some concerns about cancer risks?
I can actually do both, although if a patient is coming to me without a referral, I encourage them to seek their physician and request one for two reasons. Number one, I'm not a physician, so if any testing is appropriate, their physician is going to be ordering that testing. And then also, following that patient in the future, not only can I not order blood tests, I also cannot order mammograms and MRIs and CAT scans, things that these patients may need and I'm not going to be able to follow up with. Mm-hmm. So I look for them to have someone to really manage that care.
And Audrey, same with you. You generally have people referred to you?
Yeah, they're usually referred by generally their OBGYN or family practice doctor who's caring for their pregnancy, because the majority of my patients are already pregnant and seeing a physician.
So let's just get back to us a little bit of basics. I've written down the specific questions. What should be expected from genetic counselors? Let's talk about specific kinds of things that patients would expect to get or should expect to get.
I think that some of that might depend on what they're coming for, and I think what they get from a prenatal genetic counseling experience may be slightly different than a cancer counseling experience, because the needs are a little bit different. I always take a family history from every patient, regardless of why their obstetrician referred them, just because sometimes things are picked up that their obstetrician wasn't aware of that we can address. I could say the majority of people I see are coming in, they're women who are pregnant, who are over 35 and worried about chromosomal issues. So I spend a lot of time reviewing what those issues are, what the chromosome problems are they're at risk for, what those risks are, and then what kind of tests are out there. Are these tests that will be helpful for them, what they would do with that information so they can make the decision about whether they want to have testing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the amount of knowledge is getting extremely more and more complex, and it's certainly fair to realize that a lot of physicians may know they have a potential genetic risk, but they don't know much more than that, and they really haven't taken the time to do a detailed genetic history. So I can see that just having the ability to focus on that is a huge benefit.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Any additional things, Maggie, that you would add?
Well, in cancer genetics, we're looking at something that actually most of my patients have a difficult time understanding. They usually come to me because they're worried they've had cancer and they're worried their daughter, their sister, someone else in their family is going to develop it. So, in fact, I spend a lot of time helping them to understand that people who have a hereditary risk are actually at risk for new cancer. So I take a personal history, a family history, and then I do education surrounding the cancers that can run together in clusters or syndromes.
Okay. All right. We've got a caller. I think I'd like to go ahead and take that call right now. John, you're on line one?
Yes.
What can we do for you?
I have a significant family history of Fragile X syndrome.
Okay.
My closest relative being my younger brother. I want to know whether or not, since I don't have any manifestations of that disease, if there is a risk that I could pass this disease on to my daughters.
Okay.
And if there is a risk, is there some way that I can test them to find out whether or not they are at risk for having this disease?
All right. So you've got a brother with Fragile X. What's the risk that you can pass it on to your offspring?
Yes.
Kiddo? Who wants to handle Fragile X?
I can go ahead. Fragile X is really complicated, and we have what are called full mutations, and that's usually the person who expresses the condition. And then we can have premutations where the gene is kind of not quite there. I guess that's my best way to explain it. And so some individuals can have what's called a premutation, and they're perfectly normal and fine. They can pass that on, and it can run through families without expressing. So in essence, there is a possibility your daughters could have the gene and could pass it on.
Even though he does not have it, right.
Because he may, John himself may have a premutation.
Right.
And so if he has a premutation, he's not expressing the condition, but he just may pass that premutation on to his daughters, who could then have it pass on as a full mutation to their children.
Can he be tested?
Yes, he can. It's a very simple blood test.
And that would rule out the premutation as well?
Correct, although there can be ambiguities because this is a gene that has what's called an expansion.
And or a copy number.
Yeah, so they call it a trinucleotide repeat because our DNA comes in triplet codes.
Yep.
And for a normal gene size, there's a certain number we have or less. Mm-hmm. Premutation, there's a kind of range, and then affected is a larger range. It gets bigger. Mm-hmm. But there's some gray areas in that premutation, right. So it doesn't always give us a concrete answer.
Yeah. The way I'm understanding, you guys help me, but I think of it as a copy number. So there's a certain number of copy numbers. The reason this may get a little bit confusing is how many copy numbers does it take to really manifest the illness is where the gray area may come. Is that reasonably fair to say?
Reasonably. The gray area oftentimes is between do you have a premutation or not, or is your premutation big enough to expand bigger to cause a full mutation?
But to get to John's question, it would not be unreasonable for him to be tested.
Correct.
And then he would have some information with which to make a decision. It may be quite obvious, or there still could be some gray area. Depending.
There could still be gray area, but it could be very obvious.
Are there other individuals in your family tree, John, that you know of have Fragile X?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So that information would be helpful, but probably wouldn't change the advice about getting the testing and then sitting down with a genetic counselor to tell you about the risk to your children. Is that fair?
I think that's very fair. And one thing I think both of you brought up that, and I think John probably recognizes now too, is the reason we have genetic counseling is for this gray area so that patients can have a good understanding up front of what their test results might be. And when they come back, they have somebody to talk to about them that understands those gray areas as best as anyone can.
Mm-hmm. And by gray areas, I'm thinking also that there may be subtle differences in you, for example, John, that you don't associate with Fragile X, but maybe knowing your genetic background, we can say why you may have, for example, trouble remembering names better than that. And this is way off the cuff. I don't know what I'm talking about too much, to a large degree, but I'm trying to show you this gray area issue a little bit. It may be how much of a gene is there, how much is missing, what other parts of nearby genes are not there, are overexpressed, and so forth. So it can get kind of complex.
So what test would I need for myself?
Okay.
It's a DNA test, so if you have a regular physician, a family practitioner, or just a physician, they could order that test. And it's a simple blood test, and they order a Fragile X mutation test. And most labs are doing that, so it's not something that's difficult to get.
And is it more accurate to have myself tested or to have my daughters tested?
I would say the best process, seeing as you're referring to multiple daughters, or I think I'm hearing more than one, would be to start with testing yourself to answer the question of whether you are a pre-mutation carrier. And then if you are, there may be a time at which it would be helpful to test your daughters. And that is another great question that I've done a couple of lectures on, is when do we test children for genetic conditions? Young women are unlikely to be expressing Fragile X syndrome, but some of them do. And so if there are signs or symptoms, that may be a good time to test your daughters. If they're simply at risk to be carriers and pass this on and have affected sons, then it may be something they want to know when they're getting older, you know, in their 20s, when they're thinking about getting married. So it is very up to them, I guess.
And if my test came out in a gray area, then it would be appropriate for them to undergo the same Fragile X mutation testing, DNA Fragile X mutation testing?
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks very much.
Yep. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go ahead and take another caller. Catherine, you're on line one. Catherine, can we help you?
Yes.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question regarding von Willebrand's disease. I was diagnosed with von Willebrand's disease years ago when I had my wisdom teeth extracted. And since then, I have had a couple babies, and nobody else has shown any signs of von Willebrand's disease, including my sisters who have had children, and my mother who's had children, and my father who's had many surgeries. Is it possible that either A, somebody's just carrying this and so I ended up with it, or B, maybe my father's not my father?
Or maybe you were misdiagnosed. I mean, there's other possibilities here. There's the whole clotting mechanism has expanded in a huge, huge way, and maybe what was called von Willebrand's disease when you were diagnosed may not still be von Willebrand's disease. That's just another thing that might be worth
kept in mind.
That
definitely crossed my mind. So I was tested four different times then, and then the last time was with my last child.
Okay.
And when I was pregnant, because they were worried about bleeding during delivery, didn't happen.
All right. So the question is, how come you're the only one that appears to have von Willebrand's disease?
I am the only one. And my mom has actually been tested because she just couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. And she's negative. So, and many of my aunts and uncles and everybody's, you know, had something done, at least teeth extraction or babies or something, and it's never shown anywhere. And
right, so they've never had genetic testing, but they've never had bleeding problems, which is associated with the possibility of von Willebrand's disease.
My mom recently had the testing done, and it was negative.
Okay, all right, so we know mom is not carrier, or in fact, doesn't have the.
I'm
thinking. I don't know whether it's autosomal dominant or not. So that's where I don't know the. All right. So do we know, what can we help this lady with? So,
well, if you don't mind my answering a question with a question, I'm wondering, in your testing, were they simply panels showing that your blood clots differently or slower, or were they actual genetic tests showing, for example, that you have a factor 8 deficiency?
Right. That's what they said, and that it was actual von Willebrand's, and I'm type 1. So it's a real low case of it, but it's definitely there.
Okay. So, having the answer to that question, and Audrey may have to help me because I think she does this a little more than I do.
No, I don't.
Okay. So you have two genetic counselors who don't specialize in blood disease.
Yeah. So the important thing, but I mean, it's still, there's an answer. One, mutations have to start somewhere, and you could be a new mutation. Okay.
Right.
That's one possibility. And the other possibility for sure is the variable penetrance of these things, and some people are going to have more obvious problems than others, even though they may also have the disease. And and especially with von Willebrand's, my understanding is, you know, do I screen every child that comes in with a bloody nose into my office? I would be spending a lot of money to find the one von Willebrand. So it can be very difficult.
When I had my teeth extracted, I actually had to be hospitalized because the bleeding just didn't stop.
Right.
I had just a week of straight bleeding, and they said, okay, something's not right here. So I ended up going to Rochester, Minnesota, and
Yeah, those are the kind of patients where idiots not to think something's not going on right. But there are, you know, there are von Willebrands who only have a bloody nose every once in a while.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, how do we decide which one of those we're gonna test? Other answers or other questions, things that we should suggest here?
Well,
Is it possible that – does it just come down from the mother's side, or can it come from the father's side too?
I don't know the genetics, and it looks
okay.
– I don't think any of us are absolutely sure because we don't do this particular disease. Is that fair to say?
Okay. Yeah, I'd have to look it up.
Yeah,
that's okay. That's okay. I just thought I'd give it a whirl.
Yeah. So your father easily could have been, in my mind – have that disease and not be diagnosed.
The only thing is usually what they told me is that usually you see something, either easy bruising or bleeding from surgeries, or when he had his teeth pulled, you'd see it, especially mm-hmm. in a vascular area, but none mm-hmm. of that.
Okay. All right. You're just catching us on a particular disease we don't know,
it's
also quite likely, quite possible that you are a new mutation that occurred, and then you would have your father, you think is your father, and your mother, who you think is your mother, and still have von Willebrand's disease.
Yeah, right, okay.
I'm trying, I hate not to help you more specifically, and... trying to think how we could do this. If you will email at line1 at ksk.org, I will either find the answer or get it to one of these experts to get back in touch with you, okay?
Wonderful.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
You bet. Good luck.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. One of the things that... I guess is always a question is how reliable, and I know this is a very generic question, is some things are much more reliable than others, but genetic testing today, I think of is the results we get are pretty reliable. They may be equivocal in what we can tell us, but the results are much, much, much better than they've ever been. Is that fair to say? I mean, when you order a test or you know or you're talking with someone about a test, you generally – have pretty good comfort level with that test.
Right, because I think they're getting to where it's not a research protocol where years ago when you'd order a test, it may not have any quality control or any kind of lab control, whereas the majority of genetic tests have a lot more laboratory control and quality assurance. And so it makes it a more reliable test. Whether it's a confusing test result or an ambiguous test result, the result itself is reliable.
You hear that, Maggie?
I do.
Okay. There are labs that are more – I know when I'm doing tests, there's certain labs that for certain things I'm a little bit more liable to trust. And there are labs that are very sophisticated in the sense that they really are only doing genetic testing. Is that more likely where you see the results you're dealing with coming from?
Yes. I could say for the less common, rare genetic conditions that aren't done, you know, 20 million times a day, I really like to go with the specialty labs because I know they do this all the time. That makes it a more reliable result. For something that's a little more common, such as the genetic testing for cystic fibrosis that's pretty common these days, I think most labs are very reliable for that. So the labs sometimes you pick may depend on the condition that you're testing for.
I guess I'd like to add that I think it's important to know the background for the condition you're testing for and what parts of the testing each laboratory performs. So as an example, there's been an addition to hereditary cancer testing that is called deletion duplication analysis or rearrangement analysis. And the way I always describe it is if you think about reading our genes is like reading a set of encyclopedias, but if you don't step back and make sure the encyclopedia sets in order – then if volume C's, you know, in the beginning of the alphabet, you're not going to get the gene working properly. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's another piece that's been added in that we need to take a look at when deciding where to send a genetic test is if 10% of mutations in this specific condition are these rearrangements or deletions and duplications, and the lab you're sending to doesn't do that, you're not giving as accurate a result as possible. Mm-hmm.
Another kind of, I think, important issue, at least in much of the laboratory dependence that the public and oftentimes us as physicians get into, is we forget to correlate the test with the patient. And let me give a typical example and see if this pertains to genetic testing. In allergy testing, you can test somebody and they have a positive test. That means, in a definition sense, they're sensitized. There's nothing about that test that tells me if they're going to have symptoms or what symptoms. So someone who has a positive test to cat and has eczema, they may have cat allergy by definition, but it doesn't tell me that's what their eczema is caused by. So there's a tendency sometimes for patients to go around physicians or physicians to do a bunch of tests and then make the diagnosis of a disease based on the result of the test, which may not be true. You could have that cat allergy test that's positive, but no symptoms. In genetics, is the same kind of thing happening? Isn't it important? I'm asking, isn't it important to understand what's the family history, what's going on with this patient, what's the problem they're in there for? It's not just go do a bunch of tests.
It is definitely very important. I think one of the biggest things we see are patients saying, well, why can't you just test me for every condition you know out there? And sometimes I like to go back to the encyclopedia set. I mean, if you have over 20,000 genes and we only know what 15,000 of them do, that's probably a huge overestimate anyways, and we only know how to test for about 1,500 of them, you know, we clearly can't even test you for all the genes that are out there. But even if we could, the cost and the limited utility, and a great example is hemochromatosis, a condition where you overstore iron in your body. It's a recessive condition. About 1 in 11 people, if I remember correctly, maybe it's 1 in 9, are carriers of the condition. So quite a few of us, especially northern, northwestern Europeans, are going to be carriers. And when a person inherits two mutations, their chance of actually developing hemochromatosis is still, I believe, under 15%. So we really only test people who are showing an overstorage of iron or have previously had that in their family. And I think that's exactly the situation you're describing, that we might have people who carry both genes or are homozygous for hemochromatosis but never develop hemochromatosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another thing about genetics that dawns on me in doing these tests is, I mean, you could have a mutation if you just did everybody's tests, and that mutation is really a null mutation. It doesn't cause anything. So, I mean, you can have abnormalities in your genes that don't do anything. You can have abnormalities in genes that make things a lot worse. You can have things that modify other diseases. So it's.
I think that comes up in some conditions where they do what's called gene sequencing, where mm-hmm. they read the entire gene. Mm-hmm. Most labs will have a caveat that some of these changes that they see that they've never seen before, mm-hmm. maybe just that, a normal variation or a normal change. But I think that's very hard for a patient to understand when you say you have this change, but it might not mean anything. We don't know.
And I think populations are very interesting, too, because if you work with a population that's had less testing, for example, Alaska Native patients who come to me regarding hereditary cancer, next to no Alaska Native patients have ever been offered these tests, so our chance of finding what's called a polymorphism or a benign variation in their genes is pretty high because nobody has been tested, and so we don't know what those benign variations might be.
Mm-hmm. And that alludes to this issue that certain cultures, certain races have different problems from other races because your races are more likely to intermarry and have different diseases based on that. And some diseases are very much just in certain races. For example, maybe sickle cell disease, which is another blood disorder, which is primarily in the black race. Audrey, what is the most common issue that you're brought into as a genetic counselor working with high-risk pregnancies?
Probably the most common is because the majority of women I see are the women who are over 35, is whether they want to have any testing for chromosomal issues to find out whether their baby's going to have a chromosome abnormality or not. And the one, of course, that comes to mind is the most common, which is Down syndrome. And so I think for them, the biggest issue is, one, do I want testing? Do I want to know this information? And then, two, what would I do with this information? And I think I spend a lot of time just discussing, before they make any decisions about testing, is it going to change anything for them? Is there any benefit to them personally, looking at, you know, their entire family picture, their beliefs, to have this test? Because the test itself carries a risk to their pregnancy, so it is, for most of these women, very obviously an important decision.
I want to come back to this and specifically ask you what's so special about the age of 35. But before I do that, I want to remind everybody you're listening to Line 1. If you've got questions and comments about genetic counseling, questions about genetic illnesses, you can reach us at 550-8433, 550-8433. Toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Or email us at lineone, lineone, at kska.org. We'll be here from 2 to 3 today if you have any questions. So why 35? What's that number all about?
Well, you know, I was always taught, and I'm not even sure if this is correct anymore, that if you look at the odds of a woman who is 35 delivering a child with a chromosome problem, that risk was about equal to the risk of an amnio causing you to lose the pregnancy. And so that was kind of the rationale, is that once your odds of having a baby with a problem are greater than the odds of us causing a problem, we should at least offer you this option.
Yeah, to me, it gets back to this risk benefit. What's the risk of doing it?
Right.
What's the risk night? And once the risk of amniocentesis becomes less than the risk of what you're looking for, it becomes reasonable to talk about it. But if a mother's not going to do anything, if she finds she has a baby with Down syndrome, then the issue is maybe mute anyway?
Right. And, I mean, I have a lot of women that choose not to have testing.
Sure.
I mean, it's not uncommon. I can tell you it's probably a 50-50. I never look at the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot that it wouldn't change whether they're going to continue or not continue their pregnancy. Doesn't give them any emotional benefit for some of these women, and so they may not have the testing. And those are the issues we try and explore when we're I'm trying to help them decide what they want to do.
Right. So it's an appropriate thing to be asking a genetic counselor to help them work through these decisions as well.
Right. Because some don't think that far down the road. It's like, do I have the test? And it's like, well, if you have the test, this is the next step and the next step. What would you do along the way?
Yeah, do women sometimes say, I don't want to know it. I don't want that extra stress. I don't want to have to worry about what they're doing.
Oh, many do.
Mm-hmm. How do you answer that?
Answer what?
Answer the woman who says, I don't want to know because I don't want that worry.
You know, I just think that's I just kind of validate their feeling, because for many women, that may stress out their entire pregnancy, which may not be beneficial to their pregnancy.
Okay. All right. We have a couple of more callers on the air. I want to go ahead and do this. Here's what looks like a pretty good one. Kelly, it looks like you've got a question about autism and genetics.
Yes. I wondered about some opinions on how much they think genetics does contribute to autism, if they do believe that.
Okay. Well, first off, nobody, to my knowledge, knows what causes autism at this point, but let's see what our experts here have to say.
Well, I can do my best to answer this question. I actually have a personal family history of autism, and then I also worked in a research laboratory studying the genetics of autism at the University of Minnesota while I was in my training. And the easy answer is, yes, there's a genetic component, and no, we don't know what it is. But the more complicated answer is those patterns of inheritance that Audrey described earlier, dominant, recessive, X-linked, where it runs on the X chromosome, are all theorized in different types of autism. And then on top of that, there's a number of explorations into a genes plus environment, which is sometimes referred to as the multifactorial or familial inheritance, where you might have a certain number of genes that you get from one parent or the other or from both, but those genes don't do the work on their own. They have to interact with something else. So,
environmental or...
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
It could be something during pregnancy. It could be something... I know people are really hypothesizing about vaccines, and I definitely don't want to get into that discussion, but I think the concept of something we're exposed to affecting our genes is very real. And the other problem is autism is a huge spectrum of disease that is not well defined. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult because different forms of Asperger syndrome all the way up through pervasive developmental delays aren't that similar. Mm-hmm. And so there may be completely different conditions that are being called the same thing.
That have a similar result in what we can see. And what we can see we call phenotype and genotype. Even if you have exactly the same genotype, this is how things get difficult. You have identical twins. They may have completely different risks for cancer, for diabetes, which brings in this whole issue of what is it that makes one twin have a disease and one not. And that raises a very strong question about something about an environment. But it is not vaccines and autism. That's been pretty well cleared. I'll go so far as to say I know it's everybody wants to think that, or there's a lot of people who think that, and a lot of people get on the TVs and show up, but the evidence is overwhelmingly against that. But there's clearly...
You don't think it could be a piece of the layering that we're talking about?
A layering of what?
Of symptom, like some of it's environmental, some of it is maybe vaccine, some of it is genetic, and then the whole layer...
There's plenty of autism before there was ever any vaccines. There are plenty of autism in patients who've never had vaccines, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that there's no increase in autism when you really get down to making the right diagnosis. So,
I think that can't be true. There must be an increase.
Why do you say that?
I just think we can't be that much better at diagnosing it. The numbers are too...
No, what? Look. Well, you need to look it up. There were lots of kids prior to the diagnosis. There's just tremendous number of studies that have shown now that we know in what we call autism right now is not increasing when you really look at it. And there were lots of kids that had prior diagnoses that were called mentally retarded, lots of different things, fragile X. There's all kinds of diagnoses that were confused previously, and autism is not, as Maggie was saying, a pure illness. So the really, really good, well-done studies that I've seen really raise the question of whether there is an increase in autism. And I know that's not the popular understanding, but that is the best evidence that I can tell you. And I don't want to tell you something that's not true. I just that's what the experts in the area are saying. And most people feel there's going to be a genetic component to this. I don't think there's much question. And I think a lot of us think there'll be some environmental factors, not maybe just one.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you.
You bet.
Oh, you're very welcome. Audrey, I haven't done the research, but I know there was recently a panel that just came out for genetics of autism. And I apologize. I can
a genetic
look it
panel,
up.
You mean?
Yeah.
A blood test or a test.
A blood test, a panel of a certain number of, and I don't know if they're risk factor genes or how they're being used, but I can send it to you by email if you'd like.
Yeah, and another example of this environmental factor gets back to the allergy stuff. You may inherit from your family a risk for allergies, but you may grow up in an environment where you're never exposed to certain allergens and you never develop them. And again, you can see identical twins. One has asthma and one has eczema. There's a number of reasons that we think that the environment and it may be multiple components, and it may be more complex. It may be when you're exposed and to what degree you're exposed. This has gotten extremely complex. It is not easy to tease out, or we would have the answer.
Correct.
Another caller. Let's take Christy. Christy, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi there. I was diagnosed with spina bifida occulta, I believe that's what it's called, a long, long time ago. So that I have a neural tube defect that does not expose my spinal cord in any way. I just am missing a few of the bones in my spine. So basically you feel bumps and then no bumps down, if you were feeling down my spine.
Right.
And so I had genetic testing for my pregnancies and genetic counseling 19 years ago for my first pregnancy. And all my children have, all my pregnancies were fine, and I passed all the alpha-feta protein tests. What I'm wondering, I guess, is are there any other disorders that are connected with the mutation that causes spina bifida that may show up in other ways? Any other nerve issues or anything like that?
Okay. All right. Good question.
I think I can handle this one. The answer, I think the simple answer is probably no. The spina bifida is a spectrum, again, and it's probably the similar to autism. It's one of those multifactorial where it doesn't follow any set pattern of inheritance, and there's probably many genes that are involved in the closure of our spine as well as outside environmental things that can affect that. And I am not aware of any conditions if a person has an occulta other than occulta or a more severe opening on the spine that we would have to worry about. Maggie can add to that if you want, but I'm not aware.
I might be wrong because I don't do prenatal, but what I understood was that spina bifida occulta doesn't, in fact, increase your risk of having a pregnancy with spina bifida.
I've heard it argued both ways okay. many times, and I always like to err on the side of caution and at least offer testing, maybe less invasive with screening and good ultrasounds. Because I have had patients who have had occulta who have had a child with an open defect, but it's hard to say whether the two were really related or not.
Sure.
The environmental factors come up in this also, since we know fairly good evidence that once we started supplementing pregnant women with folic acid, the amount of neural tube defects decreased dramatically.
Yes.
So there may be a genetic risk, but there may be a vitamin deficiency that leads to the manifestation of that problem. Okay.
I see.
All right.
And I guess I have one other question. Are there any symptoms that come along with spina bifida occulta? I have the diagnosis, but it's been so long, I don't remember even any discussion of any other symptoms that I might or might not have.
Yeah. I'm not an expert, and it's not fair to ask the genetic counselors about the symptoms.
Okay.
I would say the symptoms would be any neurologic problem at that level or about that level and below, such as weakness, pain, muscle spasms, a loss of bladder or bowel function, something like that, would raise the question of something impairing the neurologic system, especially if it fit in that area. It sounds like you've had a pretty good workup, and it's probably not something that's ever going to affect you, though.
No, I've always been well, so I've been fine. All right, well, thank you very much. I appreciate the information.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Let's go ahead. We got lots of phone calls all of a sudden. Let's go ahead and take another one. Anita, you're on line one.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. I had a question about testing other family members who may not be particularly interested in getting tested or think that it's not going to do them any good. And I'll just give you an example. In my own family, I take care of an older relative in my husband's family, and I think that she may have a genetic condition just because she's in her early 70s, and she seems to have neurological conditions and some dementia. But when we've gone to the family practice doctor, he just kind of doesn't seem very interested in it. He says, well, could be a whole bunch of things. It's not Alzheimer's, and maybe it's just part of normal aging. But I think it's too early in her life. I mean, she's a very healthy person, and it seems too extreme. So I just wanted to ask how people go about bringing this up in the family.
Right.
I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, great. Thanks for your question, Nina. And I'm actually going to try to do this, and I'll let you guys jump in. But I think this, where I'd start with this, is you need a very precise answer and this good diagnosis on this lady that's in her 70s with dementia. My recollection, well, first off, without knowing precisely what's going on, there's no reason to do further genetic testing in my mind. Once you know what the disease is, then that can raise the question of whether genetic testing would be helpful. I think it's reasonable to try to get a precise diagnosis of the dementia, and it probably will require a neurologist to help you do that, not one of the family practitioners. So I would be pushing and asking for a more diagnosis before I got too concerned about other genetic testing. You guys want to add anything on that particular issue?
Well, I agree.
Yeah.
We have a caller who, and I think I'm going to go ahead and take this. This is about ovarian cancer, and I wanted to get into the breast cancer, ovarian cancer issue. I think it's a good one. And I also want at this time to remind your listeners, go to line one on KSKI.org, and there is a very good NPR, a link to an NPR podcast that talks about some of the issues between breast and ovarian cancer, genetic risk, not all of which, in fact, only the minority, I think, are truly genetically related things that we can prove at this time. However, we have a caller. Julie, you're on line one, and you have some questions about ovarian cancer?
Yes. There's the family history that makes me curious as to whether or not genetic testing would be warranted.
Okay.
I have my father's mother died of ovarian cancer. Of my father's seven sisters, four died of ovarian cancer and two died of breast cancer. The seventh one, I don't know what she died of. So of his sisters, all of them, it appears, went with either breast or ovarian cancer. I have no maternal history because my mother was killed in an accident when she was a very young woman.
Mm-hmm.
So does the fact that there's this high incidence on the father's side mean that a woman should get tested?
Good question.
Most definitely. So if you remember what Audrey mentioned earlier about autosomal dominant, that is how breast and ovarian cancer runs in families. So men can still inherit this risk. And if you think about your father, the likelihood that he would get ovarian cancer is zero. And the likelihood that he would get breast cancer if he had a mutation for hereditary breast and ovarian cancer would be about 6 to 7%. So very unlikely that he would develop either of the two diseases that tell us to think about this test. So in your family, it would be very appropriate for this testing to be done. Now, one thing that I would want you to recognize, and that's part of why I recommend genetic counseling, is that being unaffected yourself and not having mentioned any cousins who are affected, we would be testing someone who would be at the most 50-50 risk of having inherited this condition. So that means that we might test you and you might test negative, but then we might test one of your cousins or siblings and they might actually have a mutation. So there is some limited utility to testing when we don't have a known mutation already in your family.
Correct. I understand that. And then my follow-up question is genetic, and I apologize if you covered this, I came in this program late in the hour, is such genetic testing as I've just discussed for breast and ovarian cancer, is that covered by most insurances and also on behalf of an older neighbor? I'd like to know also, is it covered by Medicare?
It's covered by most insurance companies, and Medicare does cover genetic testing for hereditary breast and ovarian cancer. They have a set criteria that a patient has to fit, and typically that patient has to have developed cancer to fit those criteria, although if there's a known mutation in their family, I believe they have finally added that into their criteria, but I'd have to verify.
But does a known mutation have to be, in the case of ovarian and breast cancer, does a known mutation have to be on the mother's side or can it also be, as I said, on the father's side?
It can be on either side.
Okay. Thanks.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Bye.
So let's talk about the BRCA gene, which is what you're referring to in the information you were just providing. What are we talking about? How many people have that gene? How much breast and ovarian cancer is related to it? Give us just an overview.
Sure. So BRCA, first, it stands for breast cancer. One was found first and two was found second. And these genes are involved in preventing cancer. And so they greatly increase, if there's a mutation, the risk of breast and ovarian cancer. We do see a little higher rates of prostate cancer, colon, melanoma, as well as we've just recently learned about leukemia, lymphomas, and pancreatic cancer associations. These genes increase the risk of breast and ovarian cancer to a point where somewhere from around 40 to 87% of women with a mutation get breast cancer, and somewhere between 20 to 45 to 60% of women with a mutation get ovarian cancer. So the risks are greatly increased, and we can't tell a person whether they will get cancer or what type they will get, but we do have things that they can do to modify their risk, and that's what we typically talk about in counseling.
So how does a gene go about preventing cancer?
So the way I think about these genes is that there are body spell checkers. Mm-hmm. So they actually look for mistakes in our DNA when we copy or make a new cell. So they're actually going through and checking for any errors and flagging those, and they're getting fixed. So if we inherit a mutation from one parent, we still have a working spell checker from the other parent. So over time, something would have to stop that second copy from working, and then errors start to build up and form a cancer.
So in each one of our cells, of which there are millions, there are regularly recopying our DNA. And so if there's just a very, 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 very small chance of making an error, there's so many reproduction of our genes going on that we make an error every once in a while. And we have evolved mechanisms to help prevent that from happening. And that's genetic and passed on. And if we don't get one of those genes, then we have an increased risk. And that's what the BRCA – or is it BRCA? Yeah, CA1 and 2 genes help us do. And there are other genes we're discovering that may do the same thing.
Exactly.
We have a question by email, and we've only got about 2 or 3 minutes now, but it's a difficult question, I think. Is there any genetic testing to predict addictive behavior or physiology regarding children? So is there a way to predict genetically a risk for addictive behavior, I think is the question, or physiology?
I think the simple answer is not that I'm aware of.
Right. I think it's a very, very complex issue, the whole issue of addictive behavior. I suspect that it's reasonable to think that there are certain genetic traits that we inherit that may make us more likely to do addictive things. But, again, it's genetics and environment, and the genetics is so complex, we don't have specific genes that we can answer that question. So we can't really do much more than guess at that.
And one thing I like to do is when I recognize these things in a family history, for example, addictive behavior or a tendency to suicide or depression, there may not be a test, but we certainly can be proactive, and parents can be anticipatorily looking for these conditions and reporting to their doctor as soon as possible in their children.
When we started the show, I asked each of you to kind of think about reasons that we may need a genetic counselor. One just dawned on me that we haven't really focused on, and that's the fact that there's such an explosion of information that people who have known genetic disorders are worried about them. There may be reason to see genetic counselors again, and not, you know, every 5 or 10 years, to reevaluate what we know about those genetic risks.
Definitely. At the end of every letter I write, I tell people to update their family history and call me if they want to know more about what's happened.
We have about a minute left here. What is it that you wish more people knew about genetic testing?
Oh, I think not to expect them to tell them everything. Mm-hmm. Because I think they come up with an expectation is we're going to do this genetic testing and we're going to know everything or get a concrete answer and we'll know everything we need to know, and that's just not the case.
I think the big thing I see is people come in worried that they're at risk to be discriminated against by their insurance, and we actually have laws in place to protect patients. And no, none of them are perfect. They haven't been tested in the court system, but they are there to help patients make those choices to empower their health care. And just as a side note, I wanted to bring up that we did start a hereditary cancer group, and so we'll be providing education, advocacy, and support. It starts February 5th at the Providence Cancer Center lobby.
Okay, so
7 o'clock.
So if people want to get together on a regular basis or learn more about the cancer, the genetic risks of cancer, they can do what?
They can join us, or they can call the Providence Cancer Genetics line, which is 212-6874.
Thanks to both of you. Another fast hour. Delightful. Nice meeting both of you, and thanks for the information.
Thank you.
Next week, we're going to be back. I want to say thanks to Maggie Miller and Audrey Burke again, genetic counselors at Providence Hospital and with the Perinatology Group at Providence Hospital. We'll be talking about the health benefits of nature. I want to remind everybody, nature is that stuff that's outside of the building, and it doesn't include TV, iPods, computers, and cell phones or video games. So what can we get out of returning to nature a little bit?
Your health connection.
See you next week. Bye-bye.
If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.